Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. As California burns, oceans rise, and Greenland's glaciers melt, we explore solutions to the climate change problem with Stanford professor Mark Jacobson. Mark Jacobson is a Stanford University professor of civil and environmental engineering, director of the Atmosphere Energy Program, senior fellow at two institutes for energy and the environment, and the co-founder of the Solutions Project. He has authored two textbooks, over 160 peer-reviewed articles, has testified four times before Congress, and won numerous academic and civic awards for his work. Welcome back to the Scholar Circle, Mark Jacobson. It's great to have you back here with us. A lot has happened in the last year since we had you on last, I think. And of course, from the time we first met, which was back in 2009, when you first published the paper in Scientific American about how we power the whole world with 100% renewables. Before we go into your research on carbon capture, which is what I primarily wanted to focus on, I thought we should contextualize the whole thing within the context of what's happening today. I thought now, as California is riddled with fire and the oceans are rising and changing and glaciers receding, storms intensifying, I wanted to get a sense of the urgency that we're facing. How urgent is it now to act quickly?
Oh, it's very urgent that we act without any further ado to transition the entire world's energy infrastructure and also non-energy emissions as well. To entirely clean renewable energy to the extent we can. And that means electricity, transportation, building, heating and cooling, and industry. So we need to transition as fast as possible to eliminate all combustion emissions, and that includes the fossil fuels and biofuels.
Do you know what happened that scientists seem to have underestimated the speed with which the climate has been changing now? It sounds they're all saying, you know, we were off, and it's getting worse a lot faster than we predicted. What happened?
Well, I mean, I think there are some camp of scientists that felt that, you know, there was an urgency that things were getting bad really rapidly. And then there are others who are slower, and then there are others. Then there's a whole group of people who say, well, there's no problem whatsoever, and the carbon dioxide is not a problem to climate at all. So I think what you're saying is really the fact that, you know, we've been struggling with a lot of people who've been denying climate change, dominating the conversation. And so as a result, nothing was getting done. And now we're just seeing some of these impacts that people have been talking about for a while coming to fruition. And so, you know, even the climate deniers are starting to be quiet more. And now we really have to face the reality. So it's something that it was always cooking in the system. I mean, I don't necessarily think it was myself that it was any faster than we thought, because I think the problem is actually a lot worse than we think it is, than most people think it is. The reason is because air pollution, which kills 7 million people per year worldwide, also masks about half of global warming. So as we clean up all air pollution, which we need to do to save people's lives, we're going to uncover rapidly even more warming, you know, half the latent global warming that people don't even see, because the pollution particles, they reflect light, and so they cool the surface air, and they also enhance cloudiness, which also cools the surface air. So these pollution particles have been masking or hiding about half of global warming. And now, as you start cleaning up pollution particles, you're going to see this unmasking and even faster warming than people thought.
So you're saying that, for example, as we make the switch to renewable energies and we are not putting more pollution into the air, that simultaneously we have to deal with those emissions that have been masked?
Yes. Now, it's a little complicated, because some of those pollution particles cause warming. Most of them cause cooling, but some do cause warming. And we want to eliminate both because of their health effects. But at the same time, then there's invisible carbon dioxide, which causes warming as well. And also other gases, greenhouse gases like halogens, such as chlorofluorocarbons and hydrofluorocarbons, and also nitrous oxide and methane. These all cause warming as well, and we need to reduce not only CO2, but also the halogens, the nitrous oxide, the methane, also ozone, which is not emitted, but is formed from air pollutants, but it's a gas. All those need to be reduced simultaneously. So when as we reduce the air pollutants that cause health problems, mostly the particles in the ozone, we will also be reducing the greenhouse gases. So we'll be causing some warming due to the reduction of the cooling particles, but we'll also be reducing warming due to the reduction of the CO2 and the remaining warming particles. So if I haven't confused you.
I don't think so. No, I think it's all right. Let's go back also and again encapsulate your work with that work you did in 2009, which was looking at all the different variables and all the different outcomes from renewables versus all these other models that included, say, for example, you know, some natural gas or some other types of energy, nuclear. And you found that really the wind, water, solar won on all fronts, including economic. Can you give us another reminder, just to remind people of how you measured that and what your outcome was in 2009, and any update on that in the meantime?
Yeah, so 2009, I did a study, well, I guess it started in 2008, in that period, I did a study looking at what were the best technologies, what were the technologies being proposed to address global warming, air pollution, and energy security. And these included like wind, onshore and offshore wind, solar, photovoltaics on rooftops and power plants, concentrated solar power, geothermal, tidal, wave power, hydroelectric power. Those I call wind, water, solar options. But in addition to those, people have been proposing nuclear power, coal, and natural gas with carbon capture, and which is where you try to extract the carbon dioxide from the emissions of the power plant. And also biofuels was also being promoted quite a bit. So I evaluated all of these technologies in terms of a bunch of different criteria, all like their health impacts, their climate impacts, their impacts on land areas, on water supplies, on security risks, on materials and whatnot. And in fact, there were about 12 different criteria that I looked at, and I ranked all of these and found that the wind and water and solar options were the best in terms of trying to solve the problem of climate change and air pollution and energy security simultaneously, whereas nuclear power, coal with carbon capture, and biofuels were not so good. And it doesn't mean some of them weren't better than fossil fuels on their own, but they just were not as good as were the wind, water, solar options. And I got attacked quite a bit for that, mostly by the people in the industries that weren't ranked very high. And anyway, it's proven since then that nuclear power is way expensive. It's 4 to 5 times more than wind and solar energy right now per unit energy, and takes about 5 to 17 years longer to implement, and in addition to having meltdown risk, weapons proliferation risk, waste issues, mining issues. So that is pretty much off the table in terms of a solution to global warming, but it's taken about 10 years for most people to figure that out. And biofuels, although they're still around, most people see that they also cause air pollution because you still burn them, and they still cause global warming even though you grow crops and take out carbon from the air to do that. It takes a lot of energy to actually cultivate the crops and fertilize them and water them and then refine them into a biofuel. And so that's turned out to not, people now understand that that's not a good solution. The land use is just so enormous for biofuels that doesn't work. Now, the last main bastion of trying to avoid going to clean renewable energy is this thing called carbon capture and sequestration, or carbon capture and use, which is where the carbon dioxide from a power plant or from some industrial process is captured by some equipment. Usually it's a chemical process, although there are some electrical processes now that try to capture the CO2. And then there's no financial benefit of just capturing the CO2 and putting it underground. So the only companies that are actually doing this these days are taking that CO2 and selling it. And the only people who really are buying this en masse right now are oil companies, the CO2 that is, and the CO2 in some places that where capture is being done is really being piped to an oil well where it's being pumped into the oil well to bind with the oil and reduce its density so that the oil comes to the surface faster so you can get more oil per ton of CO2 added. And so you might say, well, how does that help the climate if you're just getting more oil to burn? In fact, it doesn't, because not only that, about half of that CO2 leaks somewhere along the line, and even more of it gets bound into the oil, which burns and releases more CO2 to the air. So we don't even know if any of that CO2 stays captured, and it just increases oil consumption and combustion. And more CO2, more pollution. So this is being proposed as the solution to global warming, and it's on its face, it's pretty ridiculous. But I just did a study looking at quantifying the actual emissions associated with carbon capture and use from an existing plant in Texas where capture equipment was put on a coal plant, an existing coal plant. And I looked at the data that was provided by the coal plant, provided to the Department of Energy. Well, so it turns out that this coal plant, there was carbon capture was added to it. It cost $1 billion just for this carbon capture equipment, which translates into about $4,200 per kilowatt installed. And to put that in perspective, one kilowatt of a wind turbine is about $1,000. So this is just the capture equipment alone was four times per kilowatt, four times the cost of a wind turbine. But okay, that's the best part of it. So it turns out you need a lot of energy to power this capture equipment. So they built a natural gas plant just to run the carbon capture equipment for the coal plant. And not only that, none of the carbon dioxide from the natural gas plant is captured. It's just released to the air. And plus, you need to run the gas plant, you need gas. So you also have to go mine gas, dig it up, and 2.3% of all the methane, or the natural gas, because natural gas is about 91% methane, about 2.3% of all the natural gas leaks to the air, but before it even gets to the natural gas plant. So you have to account for that leakage and the fact that methane over a 20-year time frame has about an 84 times the global warming impact is carbon dioxide per unit mass. So it's 84 times more powerful. So you have to account for that. And all the other emissions associated with mining the gas and also mining the coal that went into the plant. So, people have claimed that carbon capture equipment reduces about 90% of the carbon dioxide from the coal plant. But in fact, when you actually look at the data and you count for all the upstream emissions and the combustion emissions of both the natural gas and the coal, you find that over a 20-year time frame, only about 10.5% to 11% of the carbon equivalent emissions, which are the emissions of carbon dioxide plus the equivalent emissions of carbon dioxide after you convert all the methane to carbon dioxide in terms of its warming, only 10% to 11% is actually captured. The rest, on the order of 89% to 90%, is released to the air. And this is for $1 billion you're doing this, hardly capturing any carbon. But even to make matters worse, the carbon capture equipment doesn't reduce any air pollution from the coal. But instead, now you have a natural gas plant, and now you have 25% more air pollution than you did with the coal alone. So it increases the air pollution, hardly reduces the carbon, costs an enormous amount more. So it's a complete boondoggle. I looked at not only the actual case, but I thought, okay, well, you could probably make this better. Let's say you used a wind turbine instead of the natural gas to power the capture equipment. Well, okay, if you do that, yeah, you do reduce the emissions associated with natural gas. But then you have to think, okay, what if we just use that wind turbine to replace the coal in the first place? So it turns out, because if you do that, if you just replace the coal in the first place with the wind turbine, you don't need to buy the capture equipment. And you eliminate all the air pollution associated with the coal, and you eliminate all the mining and infrastructure associated with the coal. Whereas the carbon capture equipment, it doesn't reduce any air pollution from the coal. It costs money for the equipment itself. It doesn't reduce any mining or other infrastructure, no coal trains or holding facilities or coal or anything related to coal. So I looked and found that, yeah, any investment, even in wind power and carbon capture, basically increases carbon dioxide, increases air pollution, increases total cost relative to using that same wind just to replace the coal in the first place. So there's zero benefit of carbon capture at all. And there can never be for capturing carbon from a coal plant or a gas plant. It's always better to take that same energy that you're using for the capture equipment and replacing the coal or the gas in the first place. You're always going to get a better benefit.
One of the arguments they were making, which you started to address, was about reusing that carbon for something. And you said right now it's only fossil fuels that are using it. But they have argued, the proponents of carbon capture, that you can also use it for medicine and for biodegradable plastics. Is there any validity to that?
Well, you can use it for a lot of, you can use carbon dioxide for a lot of things, but there are actually more efficient ways to get carbon dioxide than this. For example, that'll actually help to save the planet. For example, trapping methane from the landfill and then using that methane, because we're like methane, if you don't trap it from the landfill, it's going to really go to the air in any case. But when you trap the methane from a landfill, you don't need equipment. You don't need carbon capture equipment, for example. All you have is basically a bag. It's basically a bag or a pipe, to send it somewhere to where, because the methane, it's already pretty isolated. The natural gas is already pretty isolated. So then you take the natural gas and you use it in a fuel cell to produce hydrogen. And then that hydrogen can be used for transportation. Now, the product of natural gas going through a fuel cell to produce hydrogen is carbon dioxide. So there you have a stream of carbon dioxide that is a pure stream that can be used for all those purposes. But you don't need the carbon capture equipment for that. And you're also producing hydrogen, which you'll need anyway, which will otherwise be produced from clean renewable energy anyway. So here's a way to take some waste that's going to go to the air anyway, that's 84 times more powerful than CO2 over 20 years, and converting it into two useful products, as opposed to trying to keep this coal plant alive. That has no air pollution associated with it, has zero emissions associated. I'm saying that being the trapping the methane from the landfill and then using it in a fuel cell for hydrogen and then taking that CO2 and using that for these other processes. That has zero emissions associated with it and no energy except for the energy for this, it's a steam reformer that produces the hydrogen, and the hydrogen is used in a fuel cell. So that has no energy associated with it, whereas using the carbon capture in a coal plant to try to capture carbon, that has equipment costs for that. That doesn't reduce any air pollution, still allows the air pollution from the coal to continue. It allows all the upstream mining to continue. It allows the whole coal system to continue. In fact, it makes it even easier to use more coal and to use more natural gas. So there's no comparison. There's absolutely no need for a stream of CO2 from that process.
You also mentioned the opportunity costs. I assume you're talking about both time investment and money investment.
Well, opportunity costs, what I usually mean is by doing that, like adding carbon capture equipment to a coal or gas plant, as opposed to taking the same energy for that capture equipment and use it, let's say it's renewable energy, and using it to replace the coal or the gas in the first place. So the opportunity cost really means the cost in terms of emissions and actual money, and it could be time as well, of doing one thing versus another that are equivalent in terms of the energy.
You talked about the best carbon capture methods are really the ones nature's provided. They're called trees. I saw a paper about this, about what it could mean if we did get really serious about planting trees. What can you tell us about this, the idea of planting trees as a means of carbon capture, in contrast to trying to do it this other way?
So the first step is actually replacing fossil fuels with renewables is the exact same thing as carbon capture, because by preventing carbon dioxide from getting into the air, one molecule from getting to the air, that's like taking one molecule out of the air. It's the exact same thing. So the first step is to stop the emission. And that's replace all the fossil fuel, not only power plants, but industrial processes, transportation, CO2, replace them with clean renewable alternatives, which there are for pretty much everything right now. There's an alternative that doesn't result in any emissions. And then after that, In addition to that, to take some carbon out of the air, well, yeah, planting trees helps. We don't need to cover the planet with trees. We need to increase the reduction of CO2 from the air. Not only replanting trees, it's avoiding permanent deforestation. I mean, we can put policies in place around the world to reduce the tree loss due to permanent deforestation. Permanent deforestation is where you burn down part of the Amazon, for example, to convert these really dense forests into cattle grazing land. So permanence, when you change the land use, as opposed to temporary deforestation where there's a forest fire and it regrows. Of course, you know, big trees will take 80 years to regrow, so you're not like an immediate regrowth. So if we can reduce biomass burning, both permanent and, you know, annual biomass burning, that can go, and that includes wildfires, that can go a long way towards also effectively planting trees. But there are all other things we have to do to reduce warming, and that's to reduce halogen emissions, to reduce nitrous oxide emissions, to reduce methane leakage emissions. I touched upon methane from landfills, but there's also methane from rice paddies. There's methane from cattle as well and other sources. So there are other things that are low-hanging fruit that we could also try to reduce that don't require this capture equipment. Because the capture equipment is literally the worst thing to use because it all requires energy and it doesn't reduce any other pollutants. In the case of even when you're taking it directly out of the air, it's not reducing any other pollutants except for CO2.
Now, you and your colleagues have been working with cities, states, countries, and have written a bunch of reports about how to go to 100% renewables by 2050. Now, first and probably most pressing question is, isn't 2050 perhaps a little slow now, given what we're seeing?
Well, all our plans have been to go to 80% renewables by 2030. And the last 20% somewhere between 2030 and 2050, ideally before 2050, but that's kind of the drop dead date. So yeah, you're right. If we just all of a sudden did it all in 2050, that would be too late. But our goals are very aggressive, trying to get 80% by 2030. And that, in fact, is more aggressive than any intergovernmental panel on climate change scenario. They basically have like 40% by 2030, 40 or 50 at the most. But 80%, I think, we can avoid 1.5 degree global warming with that transition if we can do it worldwide, not only for all energy, but also all other emissions that are non-energy emissions.
So what are, say, some steps that need to be made? You can give some examples because I know you guys have done reports for different states and different countries. And like, can you give us like an example of how some state or some country or some city can do this and do this quickly?
Well, the idea is to electrify everything and then provide the electricity with clean, renewable energy. So transportation, we go to electric vehicles and hydrogen fuel cell for long distance heavy transport. For buildings, we'd go to heat pumps for both air heating and air cooling and water heating and even water cooling or like refrigeration. And then for industry, we'd use electric high-temperature industrial processes that exist, like arc furnaces, induction furnaces, resistance furnaces. Then we provide all the electricity with clean, renewable energy, like wind and water and solar power. So, and the people can do this in their own homes. I mean, you can think of what do I have that burns a fossil fuel? Well, you might have a natural gas stove. Well, instead of using that, use an electric induction cooktop stove. You might have a gas water heater, air heater. Okay, we'll go to a heat pump instead for both air heating and water heating and air conditioning. And you might have a gasoline or diesel car. Well, go to an electric car. And then you can also make your house more efficient with energy efficient light bulbs, reducing heat loss through cracks by weatherizing your home. And basically try to electrify your own home. And this is the same thing as any building can do. There are actually now 205 international companies, including 8 out of the 10 biggest companies of the world that have committed to 100% clean, renewable electricity for their global operations. So companies realize this is an important goal. And worldwide, there are over 230 cities that have made similar commitments. And there are 61 countries, actually, that have commitments for 100% renewable electricity worldwide. However, electricity is not enough. We need We also have to transform transportation to electrify that, building, heating, and cooling in industry. So, you know, so those are basically the steps. It's electrify, electrify, electrify.
And states in the U.S., I know California is quite working on it. I saw, I think, Virginia has made a big commitment.
Yeah, there are 9 states, plus the District of Columbia and Puerto Rico, that have all committed to 100% renewable electricity between 2032 and 2050. But again, they haven't committed to the other sectors aside from electricity, but anyway, it's a start. And there's still quite a few states because they're some of the biggest, well, California, of course, and most recently Virginia, but also Hawaii was the first, and Washington State, and Maine, now Wisconsin is another one, and New York. And so these, New Mexico, these states have all, a lot of them have good resources. Well, every state has some resources, you know, some have better than the others. And California is actually right now at about 55% clean renewable energy, or what we call wind, water, solar. In the annual average. So in other words, 55% of all California's electricity is generated by either solar, wind, or hydroelectric power and geothermal power right now, which is pretty good. So they have a law to go to 70% by 2030, but I think we'll actually get to 70% by the early 2020s and maybe get to 100% by before 2030.
And do you have a sense, and I don't know if this is even measurable, but if all of these movements to power 100% from renewables is enough to sort of counter the backward steps of presidents like Trump and Bolsonaro?
In fact, part of the passing of the laws has been a reaction to the federal government not taking any action. And thing is, you know, communities, individuals, communities and counties and states can do a lot. I mean, you don't necessarily need the federal government in a place like the U.S. where you have a bunch of individual states to solve the problem. Of course, the federal government is necessary, well, it will help solve the problem and is currently even providing tax incentives to help. And that's what's driving also a lot of the transition, is the fact that there's still a federal tax credit. So the federal government can speed it up, and definitely, but it could also slow it down by like preventing permits for certain things and not giving incentives. But despite what the federal government here has been doing, there has been a lot of action. In fact, coal has been dropping as a result of all this action. So like when Trump was elected, I think coal was producing around 42% of U.S. electricity. Now it's somewhere around 25%. And several coal companies are going bankrupt. I think the biggest coal producer went bankrupt today.
Yeah, I saw that. Might have been on your Twitter feed.
Yeah, so there has been, you know, the thing that it's not because of necessarily the policy, it's just the economics of wind and solar by their mass production have driven their prices down so much that they outcompete coal. I mean, the nice thing about renewables is they have no fuel costs. You know, the wind comes right to the turbine, the solar comes right to the panel. There's no fuel costs, whereas coal and gas, you'll always have to dig it up. In fact, in the United States, there are 50,000 new oil and gas wells drilled every year just to dig up these fossil fuels. And so that means that their prices or costs are going to stay high. They're never going to come really low like wind and solar are, because you don't need any fuel costs with wind and solar.
So a lot of the naysayers also arguing that, you know, China and India are mass polluters and emitters of climate change emissions. But China is embarking on renewables at a fairly rapid pace, aren't they?
Yeah, considering their size, they are producing more solar and wind than pretty much all the other countries. So that even though compared to the size of their energy, you know, it's not a huge percent yet. It's still, compared to the size of the renewables in the world, it's the largest. So they are doing a lot, but they can do more. And they're also doing things in transportation. They're electrifying buses, you know, by the tens of thousands, starting to get into electric aircraft, or, you know, starting to get into all sorts of electric alternatives, because they have huge air pollution problems. I mean, you know, there's 7 million people die per year from air pollution, and maybe between 1 and 1.5 million of those are in China. And so this is a country that's trying to preserve itself it's self-preservation in that case by, you know, electrifying and cleaning up the air. The U.S. has cleaned up a lot of its air pollution, but still has a lot in Los Angeles, for example, and in fact, 7 of the 10 most polluted cities in the U.S. are in California. So there is actually motivation in California to clean up as well, and also other states. But China has, you know, an order of magnitude higher pollution. And so they are making progress, but to self-preserve themselves.
I suppose the other area that has been criticized for doing renewables is energy storage, both because of, you know, times when you might not have sun or wind, but also with, say, electrified transportation as well. How are we advancing technology with storage? Are there advances that are really promising?
Yeah, storage, well, there's storage in of not only electricity, but there's heat storage, cold storage, and hydrogen storage. And actually, heat storage and cold storage are relatively inexpensive, and hydrogen storage is not a whole lot either. It's mostly been electricity storage, but there are actually certain types of electricity storage that are not that expensive either, like hydroelectric power is basically a big battery. Pumped hydroelectric storage is the most common type of storage in the U.S., and that's not that expensive. Concentrated solar power with storage, even though concentrated solar power itself is relatively still more expensive than PV, but the storage, though, is actually not very much. It's mostly batteries that are the expensive electricity storage, but those have been coming down. And, you know, there are additional type. There are different types of batteries that are being developed as well. Some are less expensive. There are also, you know, there's gravitational storage where you have concrete blocks, you lift them up and you drop them down. You lift them up when you have extra electricity and you drop them down when you need electricity. You know, those are not that expensive. It's like pumped hydro. Same with, you know, trains moving up and down a hill. That's a type of electricity storage. And that's not so expensive either, although those latter two haven't been commercialized. So we don't know exactly what their costs are, or they're just starting to be commercialized. And then there's also compressed air storage, and there's different types. We don't know exactly what their costs are because it's new technology. Compressed air, like liquefying the compressed air, so make it even smaller volumes. And so that has some potential, but again, it's really new, so we don't know what its cost is. But yeah, there are options.
Do you have a sense that these new technologies are going to provide solutions for intermittence that we might be facing in the future if we do go to 100% renewables globally?
Well, right now, I mean, battery storage with solar or wind is very cheap. Now, this is like storage for the on the order of hours to days. It's not like months storage, but it's hours to day storage. So that reduces the, you know, the minutely fluctuations in renewables. But it's really cheap. I mean, we're talking 3 cents a kilowatt hour for the combination of solar plus batteries. And that compares with 6 cents a kilowatt hour for natural gas combined cycle, which is mostly baseload. You know, peaker plant natural gases are like 18 cents a kilowatt hour. So solar plus batteries beating out natural gas right now. So same with wind plus batteries. And but that's, you know, for short-term storage batteries. And, you know, for seasonal fluctuations, though, you know, people are concerned that, well, how are we going to, you know, get all the electricity we'll need in the wintertime when we need a lot of heating if we electrify the heating? Well, it turns out if you use heat pumps, you're using like 1/4 the energy as you do with gas heaters. So you don't need as much electricity in the wintertime as you do gas in the wintertime if you use electric heat pumps. So there's, you can mitigate the impacts of the seasonal variation of demand by the fact that you have less demand for energy when you electrify. In fact, if you electrify everything, your power demand goes down about 57% for all sectors. And so on the average for all sectors. So that does help to match power supply with demand on a seasonal timescale.
Speaking of batteries, that has been one of the criticisms on electrifying transportation is about battery disposal. Is that a legitimate concern?
Well, lithium itself is not a toxic metal. I mean, there are other materials in the batteries that are toxic or more of concern. But the idea is to recycle batteries to the extent that they can. So companies like Tesla have a battery recycling program. And I think that's going forward, that's the way to go, is to recycle all the materials or as much as possible. And, you know, but keep in mind, like, in the worst case, if you have, you know, if the battery lasts 10 years or 12 years, and I have an electric car that I've had since 2009, and I had the same original battery pack, so it's lasted at least 10 years. And you know, in the worst case, it's like a one-time both mining and disposal. Whereas when you have fossil fuels, you have continuous mining forever and continuous use and continuous disposal, except that disposal is in our air and that we're breathing it in our lungs. So these fossil fuel companies are disposing of their waste in our lungs. And whereas, you know, in the worst case of battery disposal, even if it didn't get recycled, which it should be and definitely want it to be, that is nothing near the order of magnitude of waste that results from the fossil fuel industry.
Any other technologies that you see coming online that are going to help us move to this goal of 100% renewables?
Well, I think the most difficult thing to change is long-distance heavy transportation aircraft in particular, so long-distance aircraft. Now, new aircraft are now available that are electric that can go up to 1,500 kilometers, either electric or hydrogen fuel cell, but we need technologies for further than 1,500 kilometers, you know, up to, you know, 10,000 kilometers for some flights, or even more, I think. And that, for those, we would use hydrogen fuel cell. And so those technologies haven't been developed, but they are theoretically possible. And so we expect within the next 15 to 20 years to have long-distance heavy transport. But right now, we don't have it. And that's really one of the very few types of technologies that are not currently available to transition. But I would say we have 95% of the technologies that we need for the transition, and the rest are not, are technically possible. We just haven't commercialized them yet.
Well, Mark Jacobson, it is always such a pleasure to host you, and I thank you so much for your research and for your willingness to share it and to work so hard to transition us into this future of 100% renewables. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me on the show. I really appreciate it.
Mark Jacobson is a Stanford University professor of civil and environmental engineering, director of the Atmosphere Energy Program, senior fellow at two institutes for energy and the environment, and the co-founder of the Solutions Project. He has authored two textbooks, over 160 peer-reviewed articles, has testified four times before Congress, and won numerous academic and civic awards for his work.